Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Interstate Batteries has been serving us for over 65 years. They are built to top industry standards. Interstate Batteries has been technician's choice for 9 years and counting. Their business is powered by a distributor network of 300 wholesale warehouses and backed up by more than 200,000 dealers around the world. They're guided by a set of common values, and they're committed to enriching lives as they deliver the most trustworthy source of power to the world. You can find out more by visiting interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Welcome to the Southern Ground Hunting Podcast. I'm your host, Parker McDonald, and this is episode number 88. On this episode, we are talking again to Mr. Bobby Worthington for part two I don't even know how you describe it, how to kill the biggest bucks ever. He has been an outstanding guest, and he has got so much knowledge that we are splitting it up into parts. And this is going to be part two, and we're keying in on stand placement. This is a really good episode, guys, so stay tuned. This is the Southern Ground Hunting Podcast. All right, guys, I'm going to make this extremely quick today. I'm very excited about this episode. We have got part two with Mr. Bobby Worthington. Now, this is during the Local Legends series, and we were not expecting to split this episode up into parts. We were expecting to have one episode, but what we quickly realized is to go into detail on the amount of things that we wanted to talk with Bobby about, we were going to have to split this up. And originally, last week, we were going to just split it up into two parts. But after recording this episode, we have decided again to split it up into three parts. So we're extremely excited about this episode. I think it's gonna wreck your world. It's gonna change your outlook on stand location. He talks a lot about how he decides which tree is the perfect tree. And this is obviously in part one, we talked about the three keys to success that Bobby has laid out for us. And in part one, we went over the first one, and that was hunting during the rut, which is the time that he believes is the best time to go in and kill a mature buck. In this part, we're going to cover stand placement. We're going to talk about funnels. We're going to talk about buck sign. We're going to talk about how to read the sign and kind of put the pieces all together for chasing that mature buck. It's an extremely detailed episode. And again, like I said in the first part of this this conversation with Bobby, you need to take notes. Like, taking notes is going to be your best friend to be able to absorb all the information that he is going to give you here. I'm super excited about it. I know you guys are looking forward to it. I've had countless messages this past week of people saying, when the crap is part two going to be up? I'm ready for part two. I've already listened to part one three times. I'm ready for part two. Well, here it is. Before we get into this episode, I wanted to remind you guys that you can check out ScreeGear.com. I've been using Scree Gear for about the last year and a half for turkey hunting, deer hunting, scouting, everything, early season, late season, into the coldest parts of the season, and it has held up tremendously. It's been awesome. I have loved using Scree Gear. You can use the code SOUTHERNGROUND, all lowercase and all one word, at checkout to get 10% off of your order at ScreeGear.com. So go and check those guys out. Also, check out TetheredNation.com. You guys, we are doing a giveaway for a Tethered Phantom, and we're giving it away. We intended to give it away at the end of the month, which is when the Local Legends series was going to be over. But since Local Legends has been, it's kind of been extended a little bit further than what we originally intended, we're going to give you guys a little bit of extra time to sign up. All you got to do is subscribe to the Southern Ground Hunting YouTube channel. I'm super excited about this. We have been doing our own channel now for about a month or so, and it's grown tremendously. And that's all you got to do is go subscribe, and you'll be entered for a chance to win a Tethered Phantom. And I'm really excited about that. I know a lot of you are waiting for us to announce that. I wanted to let you guys know that that's been extended because we are extending the Local Legends series. And we told everyone that they had through the Local Legends series to sign up for this. So go and do that. Other than that, guys, I don't have anything I'm excited to get into this episode with Mr. Bobby Worthington on stand placement. All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Southern Ground Hunting Podcast, and this is actually part two with quite possibly our most popular guest that we've had so far today, Mr. Bobby Worthington. So I'm not going to take up too terribly much time right here. Drew, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts from part one.
My thoughts from part one was I need to take more notes in part two. Mr. Bobby has just such a wealth of information, and not just information, but just the experience of killing big deer, how to kill big deer. And, you were not exaggerating last time, Parker, whenever you said, listen, get a notepad out. And so guys, get a notepad out, get your phone out, and pull up your notes and just get ready. Cause I'm so excited to hear about stand placement, which is something that I struggle with greatly.
Yeah.
And especially being new to the mobile hunting. And so I'm just so excited.
So last week what we covered was we covered a lot of things up top. But when we really got into it, we talked about the three elements that are the three keys to success that Mr. Worthington uses. And the first one that we hit in part one was hunting during the rut. Hunt that big buck during the rut, which is, you know, obviously the rut for everybody who's been deer hunting for a fair amount of time. The rut is the time to be in the woods.
Yep.
However, I have never heard it put so detailed as what Bobby's told us about. So this next part, we are going to discuss the second key to success, which is stand placement. So, I mean, I'm just going to do same game, different time. I mean, we're just going to let him go. But first, I feel like we need to give a standing ovation for today's guest, Mr. Bobby Worthington. Bobby, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing great. I really appreciate that. I don't think I've ever had a standing ovation.
Well, judging by the feedback that we've gotten from people this past week, people may have been listening to it sitting down, but in their minds, they were giving you a standing ovation. People have loved this, and I definitely don't think part two is going to be any different.
Oh, no.
No different. So, so let me ask you this, Bobby. You told me we were supposed to record part two last week, and you told me that you had a bad run-in with a hornet, I believe. Is that what happened?
Yeah. I've got a nest in the walls of my house here, and a few of them's occasionally getting in, and I stepped on one. So.
Ouch. Oof. Ouch.
That's right. I've been there.
That's funny. That I know it's not funny. I know it's probably not funny when you're the one getting stung, but
and we were logging today and cutting timber, and my partner actually got stung five or six times, but luckily I was able to evade him. Maybe I could run a little faster than he could.
That's what they say. You only got to be the fastest guy in the group.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yep.
So, well, that's cool. Well, Bobby, I don't feel like we need to give you much more of an introduction.
No.
But just kind of let you just run with this next part, which is part two, talking about stand placement. So on your mark, get set, go. Go for it.
I appreciate it. I think it's good we might back up and do a quick review of part one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's do it. Yeah, go for it. That'd be great.
Okay. In part one, I revealed that I believe the number one problem with most would-be trophy hunters is that they just don't understand what is important and what is not when it comes to killing big bucks. I discussed that in pretty good detail. I mentioned this is partly due to the commercialization of deer hunting and self-promotion of individuals who like to be considered experts, even though they may have not put the time and effort in required to reach that status. Because of false information put out by people who really don't understand what is important in our quest to harvest mature bucks, I believe a lot of incorrect information is being passed around. I guess you could call this circular reasoning. We see this in a lot of walks of life. It should be apparent that many of the ones who are passing this information back and forth and to others, they really don't have the resume that maybe they should have to be considered true experts. Of course, you guys know that you can sit behind a computer screen and be anything, I guess, you want to be. But I want to say I've spent a big part of my life singularly focused on bow hunting big bucks. For probably 55 years, much of my daily thought and effort has been on this subject. I've spent much more time in the deer woods than I have indoors, I'll have to say that. And I say that to say this, to let you know that I might know something about killing big bucks. And if you do not understand this up front, you and a lot of my listeners may not take this information to heart, because it may be seem a little simpler than a lot of stuff that's put out there, and it may seem a little too simple. So that's why I wanted to say that. It would be disappointing to me if that was the case. Bow hunting has given me much joy and feelings of accomplishment throughout my life, and the older I get, the more I feel the need to pass this information on to others. It's information, knowledge, that I can pass on, not the selling of gimmicks or promoting hunting aids that really don't make a difference. I've had plenty of opportunities to be on hunting shows, and I always declined. I can't push products and tell blue-collar workers like me that if you buy this product or buy more products, and you're going to kill more bucks. That's just not the case. Educating others is my stewardship to the sport of bow hunting trophy whitetail. Like most people who reach a certain level of accomplishment, I feel a need to pass information on to others. When it comes to things I understand, such as bow hunting trophy whitetail deer and archery, I'm willing to help all who ask of me. My fear is not that by doing so, I will fall victim to myself. My fear is that I will awaken one morning and not have anything hard to push against, and as a result, I will grow weak and perish. I don't care to help anybody that asks me, even my competitors, because I need something every day to push hard against, and the more competition they can give me, then the better I will be, is what I'm trying to say. As I stated, our main goal in bow hunting is to increase our chances that a mature buck will walk by our stand during legal shooting hours. That's it. Buying more gimmicks will not help in this endeavor. I can actually hunt with the cheapest bow and tree stand on the market, and it will not affect my success one bit. Mm-hmm. And those reached a certain level, I'll could tell you the same thing. My success is based on knowledge and the time and effort it takes to implement that knowledge. This is the only way to obtain mature bucks, that is, to earn them. If you're going to kill multiple mature bucks, you've got to earn them. That's the only way to do it. In part one, I introduced three things, like we talked about, that will increase our chances of success in bow hunting trophy whitetail. Any one of these three tactics taken alone will increase our odds of success to some degree. However, when we take all three and when we implement all three, I think it will give a hunter a better than average chance that he will be able to harvest mature bucks. The three tactics, as we talked about a while ago, I'm talking about is hunting during the rut, stand selection, or stand placement, some people might want to call it, and persistence. We talked about the benefits of hunting during the rut last time in part one, and discussed the main thing is how it can diminish our chance when hunting a mature older class buck. It can diminish our chance of success if we hunt deer like this before the rut movement starts, because they didn't get over being dumb, but I've told you how they can discover that we're hunting them before the rut, and most people will find that big sign, and they'll get excited, and they'll get in there and get set up on it. and they'll hunt it and never kill the deer, and they just don't understand why. Well, I hope I maybe answered some of those questions. We covered that as thoroughly as possible, I think, in the time we had available. So now we're going to take a look at number two, which is stand selection. If you're not hunting in the right location, fellas, you'll never get a chance at a mature buck, even while hunting during the rut. So one of these taken alone will increase your chances of success somewhat. I've heard it said that any tree in the woods during the rut can produce a mature buck, and that's true. So hunting during the rut will increase your stand, your chances somewhat, but if you're not in the right location, that somewhat maybe once or twice during a lifetime. So we got to add all three of these together to give ourselves a reasonable chance that a mature buck will walk by our stand close enough for a shot. I think poor stand location is the reason many hunters hunt all their lives and never harvest a mature buck. They do not find that one tree a mature buck will walk by more than any other or pass by even once. So I'm amazed when I scout public or otherwise hunted ground to find that the only tree I would possibly consider hunting from has never had a tree stand in it. This has happened on multiple occasions. I've killed most of my big bucks on public ground, and I will get in there and walk it thoroughly in the spring or fall. Sometimes is the occasion. I like to do it in the spring, of course, and do my scouting, but I will walk that thoroughly, and I will find that one special spot. It will jump out at me. I will realize it's that one special spot, and the only stand maybe in the whole park or public hunting that I would put a tree stand in and consider hunting, and there's never been a stand in it. So that's always amazed me. I have often thought that some of you guys may be familiar with some of these fellows, but that if the late Roger Rothair and Baron Gene Wenzel and Don Higgins and myself, I've often thought if we all scouted the same patch of woods and each picked three trees to hunt from, I honestly believe that we would pick two of the same trees, if not all three. Once you realize what's really important in stand selection, then you will start killing mature bucks regularly. So I'm going to try to point out a few things that might help you in this. Many of my mature bucks has been killed in locations that very few, if any, hunters would have been hunting. This is because that in a lot of these locations, there were no big buck sign whatsoever around my stand. Big buck sign in and of itself is not what dictates where I place my stands. I place my stands in pinch points and funnels. You could use these words. There's a lot of ways to describe it, but we're all talking about the same place. Whatever terminology you want to use, it describes restrictions, which narrows parallel game movement. This is what I look for when I enter the woods to find a place to shoot an old buck. By nature, a funnel does not cover much distance. Sometimes no more than a few yards will be inside the forced deer movement. This is the reason a lot of funnels have no big buck sign in them. However, if you take each of the forced together corridors or trails, and if you walk them in, say, both directions 100 yards, you will probably find a lot of big buck sign, particularly if it's three or more corridors. So if you take all the big buck sign on each of the corridors in 100 yards in each direction and put that all together at the point the funnel tightens up, then you would have an indication of the possible productivity of that funnel. So what I'm saying is, all the big buck sign on the trails, the 100 yards each way, say, that's leading to that funnel, you just as well, it would be the same thing as having that sign at that funnel, because the bucks that are forced there is coming to the funnel, the ones that's making the sign. So with any place in the whole wide world to be, you must find that one tree a mature buck will walk by more than any other. Oftentimes, he don't even know where that will be himself when he starts moving. You can find this tree if you know what to look for, though. This tree will be in some geographical or man-made feature that will funnel parallel deer movement. This spot will definitely be in a funnel. You see, a deer is a deer, is a deer is a living creature wherever one is found. His movements are governed by terrain features which offer the least and safest route. All living creatures, whether we're talking about rats or fish or varmints or white-tailed deer or even people, have similar traits that govern their life. To be successful, those who desire to intercept living things should understand that there are living areas where all creatures feel safe and spend most of their time. Depending on the animal, these are sometimes called living areas, they're called lairs, they're called sanctuaries, and they're called homes. So it just depends on what animal you're talking about. Additionally, there are places which all living things, for one reason or another, travel to. And of course, by requirement then, there are paths or travel routes which are used to connect living areas to where animals travel. It is most important to realize that on these travel routes, there are restrictions and obstacles which constrict travel down to a smaller than normal place. It is in these restricted areas of travel which those who are interested in intercepting living creatures should be most concerned in finding. From talking to a lot of people over the years about funnels, it has been apparent to me, fellas, that a lot of them still don't really grasp what funnels are, and they do not grasp the benefit of funnels. So I'm going to try to use a couple of different things here. I was thinking about that today, to kind of point out their benefit and exactly what a funnel, the advantage it gives you and what they are. I'm going to try to use an illustration, let's say using human beings. I think I can compare the two here. This is a sample we'll all understand, because we are humans and we understand humans and human activity better than we can understand any animal. So hopefully we'll be able to take this scenario and relate it to a white-tailed deer. So what I was thinking about today, let's assume we are a law enforcement officer who has discovered the location of, a long-sought-after fugitive. This fugitive illustrates a mature buck. And we, the law enforcement officer, let's say we're the hunters. Okay, our subject is an experienced career criminal who will not be easy to apprehend. He will quickly flee if he realizes he is being hunted. And that's the same as a mature whitetail, of course. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we cannot just rush in and try to grab him. We'll have to study his movements through surveillance and discover where he lives, works, eats, shops, and frequents, you know. These places are in our fugitive's town, which can be compared to a buck's home range. Mm-hmm. So, in most situations, it would not be advisable to attempt to pick up a fugitive at his house. When this fugitive is home, he would probably see us coming up the street and run out the back door if we attempted to apprehend him there. So, a person's home is compared to a buck's sanctuary. He's got escape routes, and he's picked a place where he can see trouble coming. Furthermore, we probably would not be a good idea to try to arrest a fugitive while he's moving about his yard and workshop and immediate area of his home. This location would demonstrate a buck's core area. He knows this location like the back of his hand and would notice any intruder approaching. Likewise, we would probably not want to go to his job because he could see us approaching and escape because we would not know exactly where he is at his job site. A job site would illustrate a place a buck travels to and spends much of his time, say, a prime feeding area where there's a lot of does. So we decide to hide and wait on our fugitive as he's traveling to and from his home to his job, say, because this is where he travels to most often. We know we'll only have one shot to apprehend him, because if he detects us, it will be very difficult to get close to him again. Same way with Mateer Buck. If we miss him, he's gone, because he'll either, our fugitive would start making evasive moves to avoid us, or he will leave the location completely, and that's the same exact way with Mateer Buck. So let's assume our criminal has 5 travel routes when leaving his home heading to work. These 5 different roads are corridors or travel routes for a buck. They represent corridors or trails or travel routes for a buck also. Sometimes our fugitive takes one route because he may need gas. Other times he takes another route because he wants to stop and get breakfast. He might take another route, one of the 5 roads, because he needs to pick up some groceries on the way to work. Another road, he might be a more scenic route, say, and he travels it when he's not in a hurry. Not knowing exactly which road the fugitive will take when he leaves his house on a given day, we decide it would not be a good idea to try to intercept him close to his house, because we do not know which of the 5 different roads he will travel. We might be waiting on one route that he does not travel down for a couple of weeks or more. The 5 different roads are not any different than 5 different trails a buck occasionally travels and leaves big sign on. So by scouting the area in the fugitive's town, a Mateer Buck's home range, same thing, we discovered that there is a major river between our subject's home and place he travels to, including work. We further discovered that there's only 2 bridges that cross this river. Once the 2 roads cross the river, they branch out into several different trails going to the fugitive's job and other places of interest. In a buck's home range, the river represents some type of barrier that restricts parallel movement and forces the movement together or through gaps in it. It could be a ditch funnel with steep banks, which the deer goes around, or it could represent a creek or stream or river with a couple of low places in the bank where most of the deer cross. Well, because of this river, we will not need to try and guess which one of many roads the fugitive will be traveling. This natural geographic feature of the river is a pinch point or funnel that narrows traffic down to a much more refined area than otherwise would be the case. Here the traffic goes across the river, is narrowed down to 2 bridges. This is where a savvy law enforcement officer, I think, would want to set up and try to apprehend the fugitive, just as we would increase our odds of success when we set up in a funnel when hunting a mature buck. Is there anything else we can do to increase our odds of success in apprehending the fugitive even more than setting up on one of the 2 bridges which he crosses regular? Well, what if we decide to put a road closed construction sign on one of the bridges? This would increase our chances twice as much on any given day. Well, this would be similar to blocking one or two trails or corridors close to our stand, so we could push the buck on the trail that passes by within range. So you've got a big funnel, say the backbone of a ridge, and it's a little wider where we want to hunt than we'd like it to be. So if we have permission, if it's our land or we get permission, we could cut down some trees and different things and push that trail over and clean out and make it look like the trail we want him to be on is really used and no obstacles at all. I do this all the time. And if I'm not allowed to cut down a tree or something of that nature, I'll pull up some old limbs, brush piles. There's always large limbs and different things falling in the woods, and I'll block that off. So that'd be the same way. Okay, let's get back to our fugitive. Even with the best we can do to put the odds in our favor on a given day, it's not foolproof even at that. We might pick a day or two the fugitive is off work, and he might be traveling in the opposite direction to somewhere unexpected. This could represent a buck being pulled off his regular schedule by a hot doe or a forced movement, see? And furthermore, the fugitive may take a vacation and return back to his birthplace, which he left young in life to find better employment, and he might do this for a week or more to visit with his family. Well, this would be like a mature buck returning to his secondary home range for a few days or a few weeks. Because of these reasons, we would not necessarily intercept our fugitive as soon as we would like. However, if we're patient, we will intercept him eventually, because we have to put the odds, we put the odds in our favor by hunting the funnels in every possible way we can, in every way humanly possible, and sooner or later we're going to kill that mature buck. But some people, I think, do get discouraged because they set up in a funnel, they listen to and read about a lot of funnels, and they set up in them, and they expect it to be automatic and quick, and you're dealing with personalities with humans and with deer. So the deer could have been pulled off a few days, or like I said, a lot of times I think he's in his secondary home range, and people don't even realize that. So I hope this illustration demonstrates why hunting a restricted area funnel during the rut can put the odds in our favor more than anything else. If we set up in a corridor, such as a strip of narrow woods where one or more mature bucks occasionally pass through, we might have a decent chance of success at this location if we hunt enough during the rut, and if we hadn't already educated the deer to our presence before he's moving in daylight. Even so, we must remember that when the does start coming in heat, a given mature buck can be traveling anywhere. When they start cruising, looking for a hot doe, it does little good to set up on buck sign. They're through with that. They're making that to advertise their presence and attract the does and let the family groups and does know they're coming through. But once them does start coming in heat, then they no longer are concerned about the corridors where they're making the sign. And they won't necessarily be walking trails or traveling down corridors for this reason. Oftentimes, as you know, mature bucks traveling during the rut don't even know where the trails and rubs and scrapes are in the woods they're passing through, because it may be 2 miles. They may be traveling 2 miles from their home looking for a hot doe or the first hot doe, or they may be between does. During the rut, mature bucks are often seen traveling through fields, crossing roads, and major interstates. They're just going in that rut craze. A funnel or restriction that forces deer movement into a smaller area is vital to hunt during this time, because such an obstacle confines traveling bucks and it forces them to a smaller location and makes that location somewhat predictable if you know what to look for when you're looking for a restriction. Fellas, I'm going to paint a picture for you to further show the benefits of hunting a funnel and maybe explain a little more what a funnel's like. Let's take a regular sheet of notebook paper and turn it on its side, and let's just imagine this represents a patch of woods that we will be hunting that has no funnel in it. Now, in both of my books, I've got a picture illustrating this, but for a lot of my listeners, they're not going to have this picture, so I'm going to paint a picture here with words the best I can. So let's take a regular piece of notebook paper and turn it long ways, horizontally. And let's assume that 5 different mature bucks will pass through this hunting area during the rut. So let's draw 5 horizontal lines spaced down the paper representing the travel of 5 mature bucks on our hunting property. We're going to randomly space these lines because during the rut, when bucks are in their rut craze looking for hot does, there's really no rhyme or reason to where they will travel unless they're forced to travel a certain place. So as you can see, if you put a spot anywhere on the piece of paper representing a deer stand, there would be no more than one, and a big possibility, no bucks close to that spot. There would be none of them walking close to that spot, and just by chance, maybe one, but that's it. Now, that's what represents where most people are hunting. When those bucks start rambling and getting their rut crazed, and they're no longer following their corridors where they're making their rubs and scrapes, they're looking for that first hot doe, or they're between does. That is exactly what will represent how they travel. And I can't describe that to you and sound like I'm sophisticated or some kind of whitetail guru and know a lot more about where a deer will be walking than you will by telling you something about his lifestyle. I can just point out the odds to you and tell you the truth about it, and that is just the way it is. Okay, now let's do something different. Since none of these bucks is passing by our stand, let's draw a dark line halfway through the paper from the bottom up with a marker. Let's just take a marker and draw a dark line halfway up. This line represents, let's say, a ditch funnel or a body of water, something that will force deer up around it to the head of it. Okay, keep in mind that a mature buck will walk three times further around a ditch funnel than he will walk down in it and back up out of it. Especially an older buck, because when they get older, arthritis sets up in their hips, and that's why you see these bucks looking real stiff walking during the rut. It's because their enhanced travel day and night, and arthritis is set up, and they would have a difficult time climbing out of even a small ditch. Plus, it puts them in a blind spot, and they don't like that. So they would walk three times further around. So this line, like I said, represents a ditch or a body of water that will force deer around to the head of it, and it could be some other kind of funnel that would force deer through a gap in it, but ours is a ditch or a body of water. Now, let's redraw the lines which intersect the black mark. This is the lines that represent the deer walking through the lower half of the paper. Let's draw them up to the top of the mark, and then draw them back down to where they were, and because they're going to travel on their way where they was going. And just draw them the remainder of the way across the piece of paper. Now let's place a dot, which, like I said, represents a tree stand, at the top of this dark mark, which represents the head of a restricted area like a ditch funnel. Now, how does a stand placement, how does our stand placement look?
Much
as
better.
You can see, as you can see, it's put three of the five deer within close proximity of each other and of our stand. If we're set up correctly at the head of a funnel, of course, all funnels are not made the same. Some of them are tighter. Some of them cover a longer distance, and some of them restrict deer movement 100%, and some of them not 100%. But as you can see, a ditch funnel, if you walk through the woods and down the backbone of a ridge just slightly, you'll come upon a pretty steep funnel occasionally as water has eroded the ground as it's run off the ridge and made a drainage or a ditch funnel. If you go up to the head of that where it begins to fade out, then you will see several trails coming together. And right at the very pinch point of the head of it, all of them will be pushed to one major trail. And this is even better if the top of it, this ridge is farmed, then there's a field on top. Even the deer that would be walking the top is walking down and going between where the ditch fades out and the field. So this are some of the most enjoyable funnels I hunt. That's the funnel I look for most often. It's not the only one. When we hunt a funnel where three or more corridors or travel routes or trails are forced together within range of our weapon, we give ourselves the odds, and let's say we're hunting a funnel where three travel door corridors are forced together. Well, we give ourselves the same odds hunting one day right there as we would hunting three separate days, let's say 100 yards either direction, where only we're covering one corridor. So, as you can see, because more bucks are moving during the rut, and because we're in a place that forces more bucks together, then it all does the same thing. It increases our odds that a mature buck will walk by our stand. And you say, well, I'm not going to just hunt one day. Or you say, well, I can just hunt one day a week, and it'd be the same as hunting 3 days a week. Well, that's correct. But when I cover persistence, I want to point out how valuable it is to hunt as much as you possibly can. So let's say we hunt the whole 25 days of rut movement time in a funnel that forces three or four different corridors together. Now, can you see how that would increase our chances that a mature buck will be forced by our stand? That's exactly the goal we're wanting. So I'm really trying to point this out, and how important it is to hunt something, because during the rut, when they're in their rut craze and they're moving, they don't pay attention to trails, rubs, scrapes, corridors. They don't even know where they're at a lot of times in the wood they're passing through. So when we're scouting for the place to shoot a mature buck, our job is to find the best funnel that we can possibly find in our hunting areas. Some funnels are easy to find, fellas. I mean, they're just obvious. I mean, I've seen open gates and an old farm fence in the middle of a backbone. It's just, some of them are that obvious. I have often pulled up an old fence from the leaves and forced it up and propped it up with forked sticks to refine deer. Like I said, I've cut down trees even, and pulled brush up. Some of them are easy to find. And before I even go to a hunting area, what I will do, I will get a topographical map and area photograph of that, and I will put them side by side. Because on some of the funnels, you can see on the area photograph, they really stick out, but you cannot see them on the topographical map. And likewise, sometimes you'll see one on a topographical map that will not show up on the area photograph. So if you know what to look for, you're looking for the geographical features of the topo lines and where they're narrowed down for different reasons, ditches on both sides. Sometimes you can see them funnels a lot better on the topo map, and sometimes the aerial photograph will reveal them that you won't even see on the topo map. But the best way to find funnels, and this has been the case for me anyway, is get in and walk the property. If I'm going to I killed a real big deer in Illinois a few years ago. It went to a piece of property I've never been on before. And the first thing I asked the guy that had directed me to this piece of property, I said, are there any creeks or streams on it? And he said there was. And I found a creek crossing and killed just an absolute monster. So if there's any creeks or streams on the land that I'm going to hunt, I'll walk them first, and I'll be looking for natural places where the bank's low where deer will cross. And then I'll walk any bluff line or steep bank, if there's any on the property, to find a gap in the bluff line or the bank that deer are passing through. And then, fellas, I'll walk the backbones of ridges looking for drainages that push deer up to the top. And if I find one on one side of the backbone, I want to go to the other side, and hopefully there's a steep drainage offset of it on the other side of the backbone. And if there is, then you've really got a gold mine where two steep drainages with deep sides is running parallel with that ridge. And that's not only good because it's pushing all the deer to the top, it also forms a saddle when you've got two deep drainages like that's meeting on the backbone of a ridge. If you look at it from a distance, just look at the ridge line, and you'll see it's a little lower there. So any deer going over or across the top will also go that way and use that saddle. Just keep in mind when you're walking around the woods looking for funnels, deer will follow the path of least resistance just like you will when you're walking through the woods. Some funnels are less less distinctive than some of these we just talked about. Some funnels may be actually made by the way the air current eddies across the property. These can be difficult to find. Anytime you find where three or more trails merge together for a little ways before branching back out, then you have discovered a funnel. And if you look at the area, you may realize the topographical or man-made feature that's causing that. And fellas, sometimes you may not. Like I said, it may be that the air eddies a certain way. Did you know that there's places in the woods that a mature buck, and as they get older, they learn these places, there's places they can go and actually smell humans from several different directions in one spot. I'll give you a couple examples. In a low place, where in the evening as the air cools, where it gets to the bottom of a bowl-like terrain feature, it will settle there, and it will be coming to that spot from all the ridges around it. So you can stand in one spot, a deer can stand in one spot, and as the air comes down the ridges to this one low bowl or bottom, then they can smell intruders from several different locations, not just one direction, if there's no wind current. And you can take I live in a mountainous area, and I hunt a lot of bluff lines, and air can be blown in a certain direction through a gap in a bluff, and it will pull air from the ridge on both sides of the gap. It will pull air into that bluff. And these deer learn that. So there's certain funnels that are made the way that, just because of the way the air eddies across the landscape. And the best way I found to find these subtle funnels is to walk the woods 2 or 3 days after a few inches of snow has covered the ground. You'll be amazed, fellas, at what you'll find if you'll walk the woods when there's snow on the ground. You'll cut a trail and walk a few deer tracks will be on a trail, and before you know it, there'll be four or five more coming to that trail, and then maybe from the other direction some more come into it. And I count the tracks. I count the number of tracks. When they really get concentrated, I'll count the number of tracks that has been funneled together, whether it's a funnel I recognize and realize why or not. And then I'll take off again, and I'll follow another trail, and I'll come up to another type funnel, and I'll count those tracks. And actually, I'm doing that during the snow, and I will add up the number of tracks in each funneled together place, and one of the biggest ways that I pick the funnel I will be hunting for is the one that has the most funneled together tracks. Of course, I'll also consider my approach to the stand, how easy I can get into it, and different things, but I really like to concentrate my effort when I'm scouting during the snow and find a lot of tracks forced together. I like to concentrate my effort where the largest number of tracks are together. Most people just cannot find that special location a mature buck passes through during daylight to give themselves a reasonable chance of success. I hope I'm pointing out here, talking about funnels, why that is and what place we should be looking for. Fellas, a lot of people just can't find it, and a lot of hunters do not recognize it as such when they do happen upon that great location. They simply don't know what they're looking for, and or they're not confident enough in their ability to find that special place. I've had a lot of people come and want to go to the woods with me and scout with me. I used to put on a little hunting seminar in the woods, and I occasionally still take a few people out and show them kind of what I've had the opportunity to learn through many years. And I've taken a lot of them out, and I kind of guided them in a certain direction toward a real tight funnel that covers a lot of distance. And once they get there, they begin to see the benefits and kind of mention this and that. But before you know it, nearly all of them will start second guessing themselves, and they'll want to move on. So it's important. A lot of times you'll find that special place and you just won't really realize it. Now, how do you realize it? It's just through experiences. The only way I can tell you, and hunting them and seeing that was beneficial and the other one. Or you can do like I was talking about, wait till snow falls and get in the woods And if twice as many tracks are going through that one spot within bow range of your stand as any other spot, then you have found the spot. You just need confidence enough in it to hunt it and hunt it a lot. If you don't have confidence in a place and you half-heartedly hunt it, and you decide after a day or two to get down and go somewhere else, then it will never do you no good. And I've also found this. Sometimes if the hunter does recognize that special place, and once he becomes an actor at that location, it's no longer the sacred place he was because of the hunter's careless intrusion. You can't be sitting there before the rut wearing a great spot out, and you can't... You can't not have confidence in it during the rut and get down after 10 o'clock and leave and then go back in, because every time you're in and out, you're disturbing the area and disturbing the deer. And I want to talk more about that in when I discuss persistence. Just about every hunting property has that special place where a good buck can be killed every year or two. This place, fellas, I guarantee you will be in some type of funnel. I know you've all heard about it. Guys saying, hey, there's a tree on this property that my dad and my grandpa and me and I put another hunter there and he killed a deer. A lot of times they happen on it by luck. They just happen to get in that area and kill one, and then they'll put somebody else there and they'll kill them. And I guarantee you every one of those is in a funnel. I guarantee you every sacred place to hunt to kill a mature buck is in a funnel. There's so many rabbits I can chase here down different holes, but I'm not going to right now. You mentioned some questions and answers later, so we'll look at that. As I previously stated, though, not all good funnels has big buck sign in them. However, the ones that do will give you a much more indication of their productivity. Now, I'm going to make a statement here. Fellas, the most productive place on earth to hang a stand to kill a buck is in a tight funnel with big rubs that are made at different times of the year and even during different years. Let me say that again. The most productive place on earth you can hunt is in a tight funnel with big buck sign that is made at different times of the year and during different years. Now, the reason I said big buck sign made at different times may not be obvious, but let me tell you, oftentimes a mature buck will be moving through a location and stop and make several rubs in one place before traveling on. He may make 10 or 12 rubs. And a layman may walk upon such a location and get extremely excited because of all the big buck sign he's seen. And he gets really excited and starts hunting there and just wears it out. Well, he may be on a single buck's corridor, and that buck may have stopped and made that sign at one time. It may be the only time he was through there. That's why I said made at different times and in different years. If you examine the rubs and you notice some of the bark is dried out on some of them and some of them it's fresher, and it's not hard to tell the age of a rub if you examine it. You can see if there some of them are fresher and some of them are older, and you can definitely see if some of them aren't here with the old scars on the trees. Fellas, there's not a more productive place in the world to hang a stand than in a tight funnel that has large rubs made at different times of the year and in different years. I'm going to say it one more time. That's so important. When I talk about that one special place and that one special tree. Now, it's the same thing if you get a mature buck's picture four or five times in a funnel and he hadn't made a lot of rubs, because sometimes if the ground's real steep like it often is in a funnel, it's hard for him to stand there and make a lot of rubs. If you make a strafe and big tracks keep showing up, you don't have a trail camera. That's how I used to do it before I had a trail camera. Or if I put a camera there and I've got two or three different mature bucks or one mature buck several times, maybe my target buck's picture there. Or if I go there and there's snow on the ground and there is a huge concentration of deer. That funnel is long enough and tight enough that it's forcing a huge concentration of deer together. Or if I go to the funnel and find a lot of big rubs made at different times, it all indicates the same thing. You got to understand that. Every one of those indicates the same thing. Multiple use by my tier bucks or your target buck using it multiple times. Now, I hunt trails and travel corridors and buck sign when the timing and situation is right. From about October 25th to November 2nd or 3rd, it's possible to kill a big buck on a travel corridor with big rubs and scrapes, down a rub line or big scrapes, fellas, if you do not educate him before he starts moving during daylight hours. And we discussed that timing where I live and hunt, and it's up to each person to do their own research. But remember, even though the timing is getting into the rut and it's warm, you're likely to run him off and do more harm than good by hunting him that early because he will still be moving at night. But once we get into the first or second day of November, I switch my tactics to hunting some kind of natural or man-made geographical feature that will force deer into a smaller spot. Most people will look for a traditional buck sign to set up on, and they'll continue to hunt it through the entire rut. Fellas, that's why a lot of them fail in their quest, and this season at the end of it, they realize it ended up like the last season. They just have not killed a big buck. Once the big bucks start hunting, and I want to find a geographical feature that will force three or four corridors together, this will triple or quadruple my chances of success. And fellas, this is the only thing in the world that will do that. Mm-hmm. That's it. So we've discussed hunting during the rut and not hunting too early, and now we've discussed stand placement and what I look for, and that's pretty well in a nutshell my take on it. Do you have any questions to mine on that?
There are so many questions going through my mind.
Yeah.
And maybe not even questions. Mostly I just want to say it's hard to ask questions based on things that you maybe haven't heard, right?
Right.
Like you have so many questions, but most of those questions are based on this is what I've always known. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and with what everyone else normally covers in podcasts, you kind of know what to ask.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you have
Bobby, you don't. Just because you're hearing stuff, like you're processing, because you're just like I never even thought, it never even crossed my mind to count deer on a funnel. Then go back and look at it and go, that one has 10, that one has 5. Of course I want to hunt the 10.
Yeah, I think the main thing, Bobby, right before you went into that section kind of talking about, you know, especially when there's snow on the ground and counting the tracks and finding the highest concentration, you started talking about an area where all of, like, scent from multiple directions kind of is forced down into. Would that be what you would consider to be somewhat of a thermal hub? Like, where all the thermals kind of meet?
Knowing what definitely would be. Now, fellas, I've never heard that terminology, but let's say I see where it could come from easily. Let's say you take a wagon wheel and you lower, if you could push it down, the center piece where all the spokes come together, and you leave higher the outside rim. You leave it up higher. Mm-hmm. And then as the air cools, the air would, per se, run down the spokes into the hub. So, yeah, it could. I've never heard that terminology. You could easily describe it as a thermal hub.
Okay. That's what I was picturing when you were talking about it. And we've talked about thermal hubs before.
Okay.
But being able to kind of put it together, especially when you're talking about stand placement. So we've talked before with with several guests, honestly, just about those high odds places and connecting the pieces of the puzzle. So what I feel like what you just did is a puzzle that was kind of a simple puzzle, or a little bit simpler. Maybe the pieces weren't quite as small. You just chopped up those puzzle pieces and you put more details into that to make it fit, like the smaller details fit together.
Yeah.
And when we're talking about something like stand placement or even like scouting, you know, talking about the amount of detail that you're going into when you go in to scout an area and finding, you know, the old and newer buck sign, you know, and finding that to me just helped me, you know, kind of grasp a little more of what you were talking about. Drew, do you have anything?
I was just going to say, Mr. Bobby, too, what it does is with the way you were describing, especially what Parker was just talking about, the different rubs at different times and different seasons. I know that I'm guilty of walking through the woods and just looking at a rub going, oh, man, that's awesome. But, you know, and then you've seen an old one. Traditionally, guys are more like, oh, okay, well, that's an old rub. He's not here. He's gone. He's moved on. So that was huge too. And then, but also making sure that those rubs are in a funnel. They're in a tight spot. And it's really cool how you can, Mr. Bobby, take huge amounts of public land and you can shrink them things down pretty quickly in the sense of, okay, this is a funnel, and I want to hunt here. And you essentially took 1,000 acres and you said, okay, well, 1,000 acres, he's going to walk through this 2-acre spot right here, and that's where I'm going to hunt.
That's exactly right. And a 2-acre spot may not quite get it. You may have to restrict his travel down. One way I do it is I make it large. I've wrote a lot of articles on mock scrapes. I'm one of the first one, I guess, that really talked a lot about it in depth. And anywhere that I'm hunting that the deer don't funnel quite as close as I want, I will block off as much as possible, and then I will make a very large mock scrape right in the middle of where I want them to pass. It's nearly impossible for a big deer during the rut to pass up a fresh pollard place in the ground, and I've noticed a few things about the licking branches over mature buck scrapes. A lot of times they're coming straight down or nearly straight down. And a lot of times they're big as your thumb. And a lot of times they're up high. I'm a little over 6 foot, and I want one up about my chest, upper chest or higher. Those are some characteristics I've noted. So there's usually not a limb where I want my scrape to be. I want my scrape to be exactly where all the force together, say the head of a ditch funnel or around the body of water, I want my scrape to be exactly in the middle of where all of that is forced together at the tightest. Or if it's several forced together here and several right on up above here, because there's still a little bit of a drainage here, a little bit of steep side. So several's going here and several's going through, say, 7 or 8 feet or 10 feet above that. I want it right in the middle of those two. And I will set my stand up appropriately where I can shoot to that scrape, and I will carry my limb. I will never move a scrape out of forced deer movement to where there's a handy limb. I will always take my limb in, and I want it a crooked limb. I want it sturdy, and I want it big on the end, and I want it coming down at a steep angle. That's why I want it crooked. I will take it in and zip tie it in place and take a good heavy rake and really pile the ground up good. Now, fellas, I make my scrapes in the spring. When I get in there and find all of my good tight funnels, I will make my scrapes in the springtime, because I disturb the area so much and leave so much human scent that if I make them in the spring, get my limb right, and if I have to push some deer movement together and get it right, and then I've disturbed the area quite a bit by winter, by fall, by the rut, there will be no human scent there, and the deer will be accustomed to. They'll know where the scrape is. I know where a good licking branch that the right height and has the characteristics of mature buck likes. He'll know where that's at. And then all I'll have to do in the fall is go in and open that straight back up a little bit with a raker. Usually the deer has opened it back up for me. If they hadn't, I'm pretty well going to assume that I missed the value of that funnel. They may not be a mature older age slash buck passing through that funnel. That's kind of an interesting scenario too. All deer have boundaries to where they travel. They don't just roam outside of those boundaries too much. And you may have seen a big buck 200 or 300 yards over here in God's picture, and you found this real tight funnel, and you think, well, I'm gonna set everything in this funnel and kill this deer here. His boundary may not extend quite that far. I've lived on and hunted a piece of property for a long time that's about 3,000 acres, and there's some people that hunts on about half of it, and I hunt another half. They have occasionally got pictures over the years of mature bucks that I've never, ever got a picture of, and I've done the same. But now some of them will run through both sides and off both sides. And you got to understand this, too, that standing up in that funnel for a particular deer, I won't do it. And I always target my deer, but if I'm hunting a particular deer and I've never got his picture in a funnel, I don't care how tight it is. There may be more mature bucks coming through there, but if my target buck ain't, I won't hunt it. I think sometimes we're hunting funnels and maybe a buck, when he's young, gets our wind, or you shoot at his, maybe kill his doe when he's a fawn, or shoot at him, or he gets spooked, or he maybe gets spooked by a predator. There is certain tight funnels inside a buck's home range that he does not pass through. And you would think that would be the one he would the most. And they might be a more subtle funnel, one that covers half the distance, a few hundred yards away, that he passes through regular. I've learned this years ago before they were trail cameras, just by studying the tracks, and I would measure and look at tracks real heavy, and I would clean out a scrape really good where I could examine and learn the tracks. And I'd learn what a particular buck's track had. And I learned this years ago that there was some funnels that a mature buck would not pass through, even in his home range. So you've got to be aware of that. There's so many rabbit holes we can run down here when talking about funnels, but you've got to be aware of that. And for some reasons, you don't ever know. But if you don't have enough trail cameras to cover funnels, it don't bother me. I make large scrapes, and a big buck is not going to walk 6 or 8 foot from a fresh large scrape during the fall and not go over and put his scent and track actually in it. So that's a good way to refine funnels even finer if they're not quite as tight as you want, is just to make a scrape. I never will forget, years ago I was hunting Illinois, and I was hunting some private land, but the shotgun season's fixing to open, and there was a public archery only piece of property pretty close that you could hunt during the shotgun season on the outside. So I got in there and found a good tight funnel. I surmised that it was Friday, or it's Thursday, and I surmised when the shotgun season opened there'd be some bucks pushed on there from that normally didn't go on there anyway. So I got pretty close to the property line of the managed area, and I found a nice backbone of a ridge, and I, right at the base, there was a steep bank coming off the point of that ridge, and it was pretty steep, and it had forced several deer trails together and made a pretty tight funnel, and I made the prettiest mock scrape you ever seen in your life. And I didn't have time to go back there and put my stand up, so I just gonna carry it in the morning and put it up, and as I was in there, I could see a flashlight and hear a guy climbing in a climber stand up there on that ridge right above my funnel. And I climbed up where I was at, and 3 or 4 hours later, I heard him hooping and hollering and went over there, and he had killed an absolute giant. And he said they was a big buck come walking the edge of that ridge and looked down there and seen that funnel and come running as hard as he could to that funnel. He said, to that stripe. He said, I don't know if it was his stripe or not, but when he seen that stripe, he run. And it looked like 100 yards where he showed me that buck had run to that stripe just to smell it and put his foot in it and put his, I say foot, put his scent in it. And when I say foot, I mean just by the way they put their scent in it, and they'll walk in as they walk on through it. It's not on purpose that it's attracting the stripe, in my opinion. But anyway, that just shows that a lot of times a buck won't pass by a nice funnel and not go over and smell of it and put his scent in it too. So
that's
a thought. I didn't really, that one, one of the rabbit, I didn't really intend to go that direction, but maybe some of that stuff is good.
Mr. Bobby, any direction that you decide to go is going to be good.
Yeah, I think so too. I did have a question. I've actually got two questions, and the first one is fairly simple. Do you use any type of scent in your mock scrape?
Well, I'm not much on commercial stuff, Phil. I feel like that once the urine is gone, all that's left is ammonia from urine. I haven't seen the difference in human urine or deer urine in a scrape. I often urinate in a scrape. Matter of fact, I don't really call them mock scrapes. Sometimes I'll be sitting up in a tree during the rut and things will be happening and I'll get excited and I'll get the urge and I'll just get down and make a scrape. They ain't mock scrapes. It's human scrapes. I got down and made that scrape.
Yeah. That's just interesting.
Excited? No, you get excited sometimes, I'm sure.
Oh, but yeah.
I'll urinate in them, and I don't see no use buying expensive deer urine. You never know. I know the pheromones. I know some of them advertise for. I went down that road for a while and tested different things that was advertised as doe estrus in heat urine. There's a lot more scent that enters when a doe in heat urinates in a scrape. There's a lot more scent that is washed into that scrape from her body parts and her tarsal glands than there is that comes out of her urinary tract. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe that we can if we collect that and she's standing up straight and not urinating in the way that they do in a scrape and over her tarsal glands, I don't know if we can. I just hadn't seen. I put a lot of doe estrus urine out in years past, and I just, you know, come on. If we could imitate the scent of a doe in heat in her urine and put that out over a scrape or a mock scrape, and a buck was with 200 or 300 yards of that downwind, he would break his neck come running to that. I just hadn't seen that, Phil.
Yeah.
I hadn't seen it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't waste my money, and I think most people listen. All that's cosmetic. Putting mock scrapes is not, you know, it's not a commercialized thing. You don't mm-hmm. buy them, but so much of this buying all this gimmicks is cosmetic. It may help 1% of the time or 2%, but you make a good mock scrape and you pile the ground out good and heavy and fresh, and you got a big old heavy limb over it coming down from above. I don't care if there's scent in it or not. That buck is coming and going to come over and put his scent in. I guarantee you, mm-hmm. if the timing is right and he's in the mood. If he ain't in the mood, ain't nothing we're going to make him do it.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't even understand the purpose of scrapes. I wrote several articles for North American Whitetail on rubs and scrapes. You could Google them and see what I have to say on the purpose of rubs, the different types of rubs and of scrapes. But that's a long subject that we...
Well, that was going to be my next question is... is there, you know, we've kind of covered stand placement, and we probably need to wrap up that portion. But I would like to know, you've talked about multiple rabbit trails that you could go down. Is there any literature anywhere that you would recommend, even if it's something that you've written, anything more specific that maybe gets more into the, I guess, the nitty gritty of stand placement? Is there anything you'd recommend?
Well, I've written several articles over the years for North American Whitetail Magazine on funnels. My book, of course, you can hardly find one at all right now, Passionate Quest. They just don't come on the market anymore, and if they do, they're extremely high. I've seen them go for over $1,000. But I probably got I cover understand placement. I cover funnels in that very extensively and describe a lot of different types of funnels, and I'm sure there's other good material out there, fellas. I just mm-hmm. There's none of it comes to mind right now that I could think of. You know, the best way to learn this stuff, and it's not a gimmick. A mock scrape and a gimmick, I use it. It's covered under stand placement. I use it in tight funnels to further refine deer, and I one of the biggest reasons, there's two or three reasons I make mock scrapes and always have. I want a standing shot. And if you guys have ever tried to put a sight pin on a buck that's cruising looking for hot does, he ain't waiting around. Well, you could grunt and stop him, but that puts him on high alert. And if he's been grunted at before and shot at before from a tree stand, he is liable to run when you grunt. But if he don't run, if he hadn't had that experience and he stops, he is on high alert looking, and when you release, he may hear that. I want one to stop naturally, and that strape, he'll always stop in it because it's right there in the tight funnel where it's supposed to be anyway, and he's going to always stop in it and work that limb and give me a nice standing shot. Another reason I make them, if there's a couple funnels of equal value to that buck around, and he comes through during the night and finds a huge strape in one of them, and then he's got the option next time to go to one or the other, he's going to come to that one where he found that large strape in and check it out and see if a doe and heat has urinated in it. That's why they make them. So that's what he's going to do. Actually, a scent post, I call them, some people call them signpost rubs, I call them scent posts. They've got the same scent in them and on them, the scent post rubs, as a strape. That buck will take his forehead and rub his tarsal glands and put that same scent on a rub, and I've seen does just absolutely lick it and just bounce around and just have a fit when they found a fresh rub like that. But there we go down some more rabbit holes.
Yes, sir. Mr. Bobby,
I'm not saying a strape is a mock strapes is not cosmetic, but fellas, when you get out of hunting during the rut and not hunting before the rut in pressured areas, not in some big piece of private ground or somewhere in a pen, but when you get out of that and when you get out of your stand placement, you lose your restriction that forces deer to a certain spot, and you get out of the amount of time you spend hunting, which we're going to cover next time.
Right.
I think you're getting into a lot of gimmick stuff when you get into commercialized stuff that you can buy and all this. I think most hunters that try to buy their way to success and don't do it in hard work is going to be disappointed. And the best way to learn funnels and discover them is walk the woods. I've lived in the woods and I know terrain, and I can see the features that force deer through them from a mile away. A trapper is the same way. An excellent trapper may not even know it, but he's an excellent deer hunter too. He uses terrain features. He goes and drives around, looks for ditches, and looks for coverage going under the road, and looks for all kinds of stuff that funnels varmints, and that's where he sets his traps. And a very experienced or an expert trapper is an expert hunter. He just don't know it. All he's got to do is change the weapon he uses and refine a few things. It's just a lot of time in the woods will tell you where game's going to move, and sometimes it's obvious. It's obvious that, you know, like you come upon a ditch you ain't going to cross and you're going to have to go around, or a slough or a body of water. And when you're hunting water, always remember that a deer would rather walk on dry land than he had wade, and he would always rather wade than he had swim. So you can use that to kind of figure out how he's going to converse across the water. And if you're following a stream and it makes a pretty good U or a pretty good hook there, then you've found a good funnel. If a stream, let's say a stream is going across our piece of paper and it makes a horseshoe up or a bend down. Either way, a bend, I'm going to call it a horseshoe to describe it, but now it's a bend in the creek, and then it continues on. Well, a deer walking, say the horseshoe goes up, the bend goes up. A deer walking above that stream, if he did not go completely around that horseshoe bend, he would be required to wade that stream twice. He would have to come on this side of the horseshoe, then walk a little dry land and go across the other side of the horseshoe. They will always, always go on the outside of that bend, and that tightens up. It may not tighten up just one. There may be one walking the edge of the stream, it tightens up, and there may be another walking 50 or 75 yards up, and that horseshoe goes further than that, so it also refines him around that to that point right on the outside edge of that bend in the creek. There's just so many funnels that you can describe and talk about that are in the woods. It just blows your mind what you can find. And people say, well, there's no hunt funnel on my hunting property. That would be very, very unusual. And if that was the case, I would make some, but piling up some brush and doing different things. But I would force at least, I would walk two different buck corridors, and when they come their closest, then I would move them on together through whatever means I had to use. When I was hunting an old buck one time, he was in no 6.5-year-old deer I ended up killing at 7.5. He had two different ridges, backbones, he would occasionally go down, going to this big holler. And I refined him. I hung up an old pair of striping underwear on one of them for a few days. And sure enough, that was just enough encouragement as it would have been. I think anybody that come across that was just enough encouragement to force him to the other. So you got to use a lot of imagination, but I don't think products is going to help you much as your mind and the time you put it. It's just like anything else. The more you do it, the better you become at it. And the more you're in the woods, the more things will begin to open up to you. And if you'll get in there far enough, I don't like to get in a snow, no 6 or 8 inch deep snow. I like to do this in a 2 to 3 inch snow, because if it's too much of a snow, that snow itself may alter where the deer walks because of the difficulty. So, but if you can get in there with a 2 or 3 inch snow, every time it snows, get in your hunting woods and walk, and I may see the funnels without the snow, but you may not. You may not have that experience, and it may really open up your eyes to what is causing deer to walk where they do, and that is exactly what you have to learn.
Wow. I'm blown away, man. I think this is going to take some time for me to process. I mean, yeah. You've got me, you've been talking, and I've been looking at Onyx already.
Yeah.
And so I think, guys being able to process this and really think through it. I mean, here we are only on part two, and we've talked for another hour and a half. So we're definitely going to have to do a part three. Which I don't think anybody's upset about. I'm sure most people will be like, why can't we just knock out 3 hours right now?
Yeah.
But we also have family, so we've got to...
Yeah. And also, it's the one that Mr. Bobby says is the most important one.
Exactly. Exactly. So I think being able to do that... And then another thing that we're going to do is we're going to do some Q&A.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to be asking some questions from listeners, people who have listened to the show. I put it on Facebook a minute ago, and I've already got lots of questions. So... we're going to have some Q&A. Mr. Bobby, I do appreciate it again, man, and thank you so much for giving us your time today.
You're very welcome. I've really enjoyed it, and I appreciate you all making me feel important.
Okay, well, that is part two of, part two of the Bobby Worthington interviews within the Southern Ground Local Legends series. So it's kind of like a little bullet point under Bobby Worthington, and we've enjoyed talking with him. It's been a pleasure. We actually thought about doing this. Basically, we're just going to start our own podcast, and it's going to be called The Bobby Worthington Show, and we're going to just call him up and just talk and just have him talk away, and it's $1 million idea, I guarantee you. That's all we're going to do in our podcast from now on is just talk to Bobby Worthington. And no, I'm just kidding. But we have definitely appreciated him being able to take the time to come on the show and give us all of his information that he has acquired over the years, and just being absolutely like crazy successful. Like I've said before, I don't know how to confine this episode in a nutshell, or these series of episodes in a nutshell, but it has been truly eye-opening for me. I hope it has been for you guys as well. Again, check out ScreeGear.com. You can use the code SOUTHERNGROUND, all lowercase, all one word, at checkout and get 10% off your order there. Check out TetheredNation.com. We are giving away a Tethered Phantom at the end of this series. The very last episode of this series, we will tell you who has won the Tethered Phantom saddle. That's about it, guys. Make sure you check us out on Facebook and on Instagram at Southern Ground Hunting. You can find us on YouTube by going to youtube.com/southerngroundhunting. That's going to be it, guys. You guys have a great week. I know a lot of you are scouting, getting ready for the season. If you are going to be out in the woods, remember that God gave you dominion over the birds of the air, the fish of the sea, and the beasts of the earth. So go out and exercise that dominion. We will talk to you next week for part 3 of the Bobby Worthington series. You guys, we'll talk to you next time.